You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 15th, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
On the day after Valentine's Day. How's everyone?
Great. Super. How's everyone doing?
And only 3 days after Darwin Day.
I was talking to my niece earlier tonight, and I said, you know, I actually think that nobody gets, like, more of anything on Valentine's Day other than annoyed. Like, does anyone actually enjoy Valentine's Day? For real?
Jeez, you're such a hopeless romantic.
You enjoy it so long as you don't buy into any of the hype. So long as you ignore it. Like,
yeah.
I always have a nice Valentine's Day because most of my days are nice. So.
See that? Every day's Valentine's Day.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying, though? Is anyone, like, looking forward to Valentine's Day? Or
Hallmark.
I think it's just a lot of high expectations and a lot of disappointment.
Yeah, you're right. It's total BS. That's what I'm saying. If you just ignore it, you'll be fine.
Yeah, but you see, Rebecca, when you're a guy, you can't.
But no, Jay, when you're me and everyone else who hates Valentine's Day but would rather everyone just shut up about it, like, the worst thing about Valentine's Day is all the people who complain about Valentine's Day. To me, it's 1,000 times worse than the people who like Valentine's Day.
Get the hint, Jay?
Wow.
Just saying. It gets
but
old.
Am I wrong?
No, I'm saying I agree with you.
All right, thank you.
It's ingrained in us when we're young. You know, in school, they use it as an excuse not to teach math or science or something, right? Because it's about handing out candy to kids and you know.
It's a Hallmark conspiracy.
Yeah.
Guys pretend that they're interested or like it, and all they're doing is just hoping that they don't get yelled at, right? I mean, that's pretty much what it boils down to.
It's a high-stakes holiday. Is that what you're saying, Jay?
I mean, I guess it is for guys who aren't in relationships where they can actually talk to their partner. Like, it's never a problem for whoever I'm seeing because we talk about it beforehand. Do you want to do anything for Valentine's Day? No. Okay.
No, that's true. My wife and I had a similar conversation. Yeah. It's like, yeah, you know, we don't need to buy into it. It's also a really, really bad time to either go to a restaurant, forget it.
Oh, yeah.
Or what you can do, buy flowers at you know, totally elevated prices. You know,
exactly.
Buy them some other time.
When it's super cheap.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I'll do it for my wife. I'll buy her flowers on non-occasions, right?
Yeah.
And just because, and she loves it, absolutely loves that. And in fact, I think she appreciates it more than when it's kind of, when I have a cue otherwise, like for a holiday.
When it's dictated by society.
Exactly, yeah. Right.
Hey, you know what else is this week?
Well, what?
What could
well,
it be?
Well, on Saturday, February 18th, which is the date that I think most people listen to this show, it is the anniversary of the discovery of Pluto. Pluto, which you might remember as a planet, but you'd be wrong. It is, of course, famously no longer considered a planet. Although it sort of got upgraded because now instead of being like the tiniest, stupidest planet, it's now the second most massive dwarf planet in the solar system.
So it's not even the biggest dwarf planet.
It's shut up, Steve. Let Pluto have this.
Most
okay?
massive dwarf planet? Is that like jumbo shrimp?
Right.
It is a little bit like being the world's tallest little person, but you know, let Pluto celebrate this. So yes, Pluto was discovered in 1930 by Clyde Tombaugh. And until it was declared not a planet, it was the only planet to be found by an American astronomer, which happened after 3 decades of work at the Lowell Observatory. But Tombaugh himself didn't join the search until April of 1929. So he only had to spend a year looking for it, and he got all of the accolades. If by all the accolades you mean no one actually remembers his name outside of lovers of science history.
Pissed off astronomers at that observatory.
Yeah, right. So he practically just walked in there, took one look in the glass, relatively speaking, and said, hey, what's that? Yeah. Look at that. I think that's the...
There it is.
And they're all like, ah.
Yep. Yeah.
I hope it becomes a dwarf planet.
Yeah, I think that explains everything, actually. It's just a lingering rivalry that forced them to demote Pluto.
Well, let's move on to some news items. Bob, I'm fascinated to hear you tell us about the science of ponytails.
Yeah, this one was a lot of fun. I really love it when physics illuminates these common everyday things that you may never guess could have interesting properties. But recently, researchers for the first time have described mathematically the ponytail, which allows them to predict what kind of shape it will have, which apparently has been something that's been very difficult to do up until now. This seemingly mundane advance could actually lead to advances in industries as diverse as textiles, hair products, and, of course, computer animation. So, yes, guys, it seems that we have finally figured out the elusive ponytail shape equation. Doesn't that sound like an episode title for The Big Bang Theory?
The ponytail shape equation.
That's true.
I find this about as interesting as Valentine's Day.
Oh, God. Much more. But, you know, it's really not as goofy as it sounds. And why? Because it's physics. Duh. But Raymond Goldstein, check this out. I've never heard this before. This Raymond Goldstein is the Schlumberger Professor of Complex Physical Systems in Cambridge. Schlumberger? What does that mean?
Schlumberger.
I've never heard that
before, but it sounds cool.
I'm guessing
the guy who donated that.
Wow.
The money for the chair.
Schlumberger.
That's what you do.
Okay.
If you want the Bob Novella chair of whatever physics, you donate $2 million to a university, and then they will create a chair in your name.
Okay. Maybe I'll do that one day.
Or you just buy a chair and sneak it in. Probably won't even notice.
A $2 million chair.
My chair.
So Goldstein said, to be able to reduce this problem to a very simple mathematical form, which speaks immediately to the way in which the random curliness of hair swells a ponytail, is deeply satisfying. Physicists aim to find simplicity out of complexity, and this is a case in point. So how do they do it? So what this British team of researchers did was to take samples of real hair switches that you can buy commercially in lots of different places, and they removed like a bunch of random sample hairs, and they, for each individual hair, they measured different things like the curvature, the random curvature of the hair, which of course is known as curliness, and they then, what they did is they took all this hair and they made a bunch of ponytails with it, and they documented their average shape. So using this data, they were able to put together what's called the equation of state, which basically balanced the individual forces that determine the ponytail shape, such as gravity and stiffness, and something that they call swelling pressure that's created by the curliness itself. And the coolest thing about this quantity is that they devised a mathematical quantity called the Rapunzel number, which I thought was very clever. So how awesome was that? I love when scientists do that. To give you an idea, though, of what this number is, because they really didn't go into much detail about what this Rapunzel number was, but they gave some examples of what it could be used for. If you had a sample of hair that's short and springy and has a very low Rapunzel number, then the ponytail will kind of like fan outwards. But if you had longer hair with a higher Rapunzel number, then it kind of just hangs down because gravity kind of like is the dominant force there. So with this equation that they created with this Rapunzel number, they were able to predict the shapes of various ponytails. What they did was they would take these measurements and create the equations. Then they would cut the hair and run the equation again and predict what it would look like and then compare it to what it really looked like, and it matched up. Bam, one to one. They really nailed it. And you may think that's cool, but so what? How is this going to affect my life, right, Jay? You're thinking that, right?
I thought that 10 minutes ago.
Okay. Oh, boy. So, by understanding how ponytails work, you're really understanding the structure of natural material that's composed of random fibers, which is really all over the place. So this could lead to insights into things like wool and fur, which have, you know, entire industries built around them. But more interesting for me was the benefit for animation and computer graphic industries. A lot of this research I read kept going on about how hair and fur has always been very difficult to portray realistically. But in much of the research I did, I just echoed the sentiment over and over. And, you know, maybe I don't have enough of a trained eye, but I think that they've pretty much nailed hair and fur. I mean, some of the latest computer-generated movies I've seen, it just seems so natural and fluid. And yeah, I mean, yeah. I remember looking at remember the daughter in The Incredibles with her thin black hair and how mm-hmm. it would move. And how about the furry monsters in Monsters, Inc.? I mean, mm-hmm. they made some great breakthroughs in hair and fur for those movies. And, yeah, I'm sure there's little subtle things that they could tweak, but I that kind of struck me as, well, I thought they really kind of nailed that stuff. So I'll end this with just one more quote from Goldstein that was kind of funny. He said, somehow a bunch of balding, middle-aged men sitting around a table came up with the idea that the ponytail was the embodiment of all this interesting physics. Mm-hmm. So kind of a fun story.
Yeah, it is cool. Yeah, sometimes it's amazing how complicated the science is behind something so simple. Like, why do ponytails fan out? The next item I want to cover is about online surveys. Have you guys ever taken an online survey?
Sure. I always avoid them. Almost always.
I used to do it for money.
Is that right?
When I was in college, there were websites that would arrange all these surveys. You could just take a whole bunch of them in a row and get like 50 cents a survey.
So you would do like 1,000 surveys.
You'd sit down with your cheap beer and your, microwave dinner.
Would you try to answer them accurately, Rebecca, or did you just click on whatever and just click, click, click?
Depending on my mood. Mostly accurately. Because, they're paying me 50 whole cents. I'm
pretty good incentive.
Give it my all. Yeah.
50 cents.
Yeah.
I've taken surveys that are about products that I've purchased. I send you like a customer survey about the quality of the product and stuff like that, but nothing like Rebecca. Like, I'm not answering questions about how fertile am I and stuff like that.
That's pretty much all I answered questions about.
Well, what prompted this news item was an article about, do you guys remember the issue of whether or not to teach alternative medicine in universities and medical schools? It's come up primarily in Australia recently, and a new group, Friends of Science and Medicine, formed. Now they have over 400 professionals essentially protesting the teaching of pseudoscience and nonsense in universities as if there was real medical science. And the defenders of nonsense, or you can call it alternative medicine, have been very active in trying to defend, their position and attack, their critics. And there was an article about this issue recently, and at the end of the article was a typical dumb survey, an online survey, which I think is probably a good gimmick to draw people to an article or to a website. But the article simply said, do you think universities should teach alternative medicine? At one point, the number of votes dramatically increased and was massively against teaching alternative medicine in universities. And the final tally was something like 70% no and 30% yes after 877,000 votes. So now the alternative medicine proponents, or some of them, are griping about the fact that the online survey was hacked or was gamed. They were all set to use the numbers to show how popular alternative medicine is. Now they're afraid that the critics are going to use it to show that it's not that popular. So two issues were brought up. The first one I think we could dispense with very quickly. This whole thing is an exercise in the argument from popularity, which, I argue is about the most irrelevant thing for this particular issue, because the whole issue here is that shouldn't universities be promoting rigorous standards of science and scholarship despite public opinion? So you almost have to not care what the public opinion is about the issue, right? When the whole point is that they should not be going along with what's popular. They should be doing what's intellectually correct, right? But the other issue is about the reliability of online polls, of online polling, which, we've talked about some of the foibles of surveys in general, and online surveys or online polls are even worse than a scientific survey, because they're not done scientifically, so they are in fact worthless no matter what. So complaining about a worthless survey being rendered worthless because somebody broke it or gamed it is incredibly naive. Right, so you guys are familiar with the fact that people who read P.Z. Meyer's blog, Pharyngula, he will often, whenever anyone points him to one of these online surveys that has anything to do with science or skepticism or religion, mm-hmm. he will unleash his readers to say, go and break the poll. Because just by directing his readers to that poll, it completely overwhelms the results. But I think there's some interesting issues here, you know, because if you really break it down, what you're asking is, well, what are you measuring? What is the poll measuring? It purports to measure public opinion on the question asked, but it's actually not measuring that, or at least the influence of public opinion on the results of the poll are usually overwhelmed by other things that are being measured. For example, you're measuring the ability of communities to marshal their online followers or the online community to influence the poll. In fact, in the very article where the proponents of alternative medicine were complaining about this, they admitted that they well, let me read you a quote. This is from Justin Howden, that he said that in an email sent by the Complementary Healthcare Council of Australia to members of its mailing list urging them to vote, the organization's consumer affairs director, Justin Howden, noted that the no vote was streets ahead and said, "We need to fight fire with fire." So they were admitting that they were trying to break the poll too by directing their members to vote a certain way, and they just lost. So, in fact, you're not really measuring public opinion with these polls. Even if someone doesn't hack into it and literally rig the results, it still is completely worthless.
The nature of polls in general, I think, is worthless. And it doesn't really matter what the topic is, because how do you even know how the question gets framed? And does the person really understand what they're answering, right? There could be different interpretations for 10 different people of the same question.
So yeah, but are you saying they have no utility? You can't get any valuable data from a poll?
I think you have to structure it really, really tightly, right? So that you got to cut down that level of ambiguity. And there's, I think, a big range of ambiguity in the majority of polls.
We do have to at least break quote-unquote polls or surveys up into two broad categories, scientific surveys and the non-scientific ones, like an online poll. They're not scientific because there's no way to control for the population that is answering it, so you don't know what it's representative of. You can't extrapolate from it to anything because you have no knowledge about it. It's self-selective and quirky, right? So just those are completely worthless. For a scientific survey, I wouldn't call a scientific survey useless. I think they run the spectrum from useless to reasonable, depending on, as you say, Evan, how rigorously you control for potential biases. And there's many ways to bias a survey, either consciously or unconsciously, by how you frame the question, whether you're asking the question in a positive way or a negative way. Are you linking it to anything? By what question you asked before the question that you're focusing on? We've discussed this in the context of asking people if they quote-unquote believe in evolution. Well, it depends on what other questions you're asking them and how the question is exactly framed. If you state it as in opposition to belief in God, where you're sort of assuming that the two things are in conflict, then that drives way down the number of people who are willing to say they believe in evolution. If by clicking that box, they also have to be saying, "I don't believe in God," well then, anyone who believes in God is going to be less likely to do that. Whereas if you decouple those things or really try to isolate them, more people will say that they accept that evolution happened. So it is a science. It's very difficult. And you have to make decisions about how you're defining things and how you're selecting your population. Is it representative? And there's all kinds of ways that it could be biased. And if you do a bad job, you end up with a misleading or worthless survey. And that's within surveys that are trying to be scientific. Unscientific surveys are completely worthless. And it was just ridiculous to see people fighting over the results of an online survey as if at any point it could possibly mean anything.
I'm just really pleased with the headline on the piece. "Vote on alternative medicine falls victim to dark arts of the internet."
No, it falls victim to the inherent nature of online polls.
It's magic, Steve.
It's the dark arts.
It's magic. Evil magic. Witchcraft.
Yeah.
You're not only saying don't trust the results, you're saying don't even bother joining one.
Well, I mean, if you want to do it for fun, I don't care. But I mean, nobody should take those results seriously.
So don't.
One of the articles about this topic there was a poll.
A poll?
That said, do you think online polls are reliable?
That's awesome.
Yes or no.
That's the best poll I've heard.
And that poll was broken. Somebody gamed that poll and distorted the results.
It's turtles all the way down.
Yeah, it's turtles all the way down.
Right.
All right. All right, let's move on. Jay, you have to tell us about the latest battery breakthrough. Once again, we have a game changer that's going to completely alter battery technology as we know it.
Sweet.
Maybe.
Finally.
I find that I'm really interested whenever these stories come out about new battery technology because, we've reported on them a lot. We see them a lot. And they promise a lot. But typically, as you read the details and you find out where they are in the research and you know what progress do they think that they're going to make versus what have they made during the recent studies and whatnot, you get to the point where you're like, it's never going to happen, you know. But they promise all these really cool ideas, but it just doesn't manifest because batteries are so incredibly hard to make and to improve upon. We only make incremental improvements on batteries. So as I read this and give you a little bit of information about this, you know, yet another company with yet another really interesting battery idea. Just understand that it's probably not going to go anywhere. It's just part of the hundreds of companies out there, if not thousands of companies that are working on improving battery technology. So this particular company called BAE Systems is working on something I've never heard of before as far as battery technology goes. They're making a battery that actually would act as part of the structure of whatever it is that they're building. So as an example, if you're building, say, some type of aircraft, the battery of the airplane could actually be the wing or the fuselage. It's incorporated into the structure of the actual object that they're building, or maybe components of that.
Something on the wing.
So yeah, there's something. So it's a great idea, and they're saying that they want to build it out of carbon fiber, and right now they have prototypes. They have something that is roughly giving about 1/10 of the power of a top end battery right now, which, you know, that's not really usable. It's not something that we would want to develop or work with now. They have to improve this technology, but you know, they have some serious hurdles that they have to be able to cross before we would even be able to get there. And then, you know, when you think about it, what would you do with this battery when it runs out? You know, you'd have to recharge it. Well, then if it's part of the structure, then how many times can you recharge it before it would actually need to be replaced? And all these concerns come in.
Battery technology is very complicated because in order to have a useful battery, it needs to have a suite of features all at the same time. It needs to be fairly lightweight, needs to be able to be charged and discharged fairly quickly. It needs to have a usable capacity. It needs to have charge discharge cycles. It can't use any really expensive, really toxic, or really rare components. And it needs to do all of these things at the same time. And if any one of them is really bad, it's a deal breaker. You can be really good in all of the other categories, but one that's very, very bad, you know, if it takes a month to recharge it, it's not going to be in your cell phone. If it has, you know, Einsteinium components that are whatever, something really rare that's going to cost $1,000 an ounce, you're not going to see it in your cell phone or your car. If the capacity is very low or it weighs a ton, you know, any one of those things that's off, and it's a deal breaker. So I think when we read these news items, they're always focusing on one or two of the positives. Oh, we found whatever, a battery that has a huge capacity or that has a huge recharge rate or whatever. And then there's always one of the other features is really poor, and then we're being told that, but the developers or the engineers are confident that they'll be able to get this feature up to the range where it needs to be, but then we never hear from it again.
Yeah, that's actually the reason why they evaporate and you never hear about them again, is because they couldn't get past that hurdle or a couple of those hurdles that Steve mentioned.
It's non-trivial. You know, like in this case, it's an interesting idea. I won't say it's a good idea. It's an interesting idea to have a structural battery, but the storage capacity is 1/10 of like a lithium-ion battery. So, you know, is it really useful then for a lot, really limits its utility for many, if not most applications. But
what, Steve, what'd you say? It was 1%?
1/10
1/10
of a lithium-ion battery. So if you think about like your cell phone, if the cell phone itself is a battery, okay. But if it's got to weigh 10 times as much as and actually, I don't know if it's 1/10 by weight, but you know, let's say it's got to be, you have to have 10 times as much of it as the battery inside the cell phone. I don't know. We have to do the calculation. Would that actually be an advantage or not?
You'd have to have a belt or something you wear while your phone kind of has a umbilical cord to it. Maybe something like that.
What?
I don't know. Well, right. You know, if you have to, if you need 10, that's for argument's sake, 10 times the weight or 10 times the surface area, whatever you're going to call it. Right, you'd have to wear a harness.
Well, it becomes pointless.
Well,
I think you'd rather have just.
I think the point to this technology is to actually use the space that we typically use for construction material, or infrastructure material, to actually use that as part of the battery, so you have more space, or the overall object could be lighter. And I don't think it's a bad idea. I mean, you never know, Steve. That's one of the things about science. You just don't know what's going to strike and what's not going to strike. And this could be one of those things where, you know, it could end up leading to something else. But I think the idea is very clever. And it seems like they've gotten somewhere with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, like all those other companies, you know, they need to push forward and see if they could get over those hurdles or whatnot. But one thing I wanted to ask you guys, if they were able to do this, what applications do you think, other than the most obvious, what applications would you think we could use to incorporate batteries into the structure of things?
Well, I mean, that does bring up the question, you know, if it's part of the structure and then the battery wears out and you need to replace it, then you're in the position of not only having to replace the battery but a key piece of structure. So anything like that, again, could really limit its utility. Things that would have a large amount or surface area of this like carbon fiber structural element so that all of that could be a battery, then that would make it more useful, right? So like one of the things they're talking about is an electric car where the whole body frame is a battery.
Maybe it'd be segmented though, like a, you know, the rear right side fender or something is one part of the battery, and as parts go, you replace just parts at a time, maybe something like that.
No, that's interesting, Evan. I didn't think about that. Maybe, yeah, you do piece it out where there are accessible parts of the structure, and then you're not, you know, it's not like you're having to take the frame of the car out as the battery. That would be prohibitive. But, yeah, I could see that.
And, guys, don't forget that conventional batteries will never have the energy density of hydrocarbons. I mean, if you look at thermodynamics, I mean, there's fundamental limitations there that you're not going to surpass unless we come up with some type of battery technology that is completely different than lead acid, lithium ion. We are just not going to get there. And the laws of physics says, sorry, you ultimately can create cool batteries, but you're not going to beat hydrocarbons, at least with the conventional battery technology that we have.
Well, changing gears a little bit, have you guys heard about the video of a mammoth walking across a river or a lake?
Heard it.
Oh,
I
yeah.
Watched it.
It's hard not to. It's everywhere.
What do you
it's
think
very
about
exciting
it?
That scientists have finally cloned a baby mammoth, and next thing you know, they'll be strapping a jetpack to its back.
That's right.
We can only hope.
And released it into the wild.
Release the mammoth.
It's the best way to see if it worked.
Yeah, this one's been making the round. It's of course, a blurry video at that perfect distance that you can't quite make out what it is, but it has a sort of suggestive form of a small, either a dwarf or a baby mammoth walking across it's like a forest.
Shallow
river. Yeah, it's a shallow body of water.
It seemed to be struggling a little bit. It seemed like the current was, he was trying to be careful and moving very slowly.
This is one of those videos where I do think that the Netiverse is getting a little bit more savvy with this sort of thing, other than like the hardcore cranks. I think probably most people saw this and realized that's probably not an actual mammoth. And there's, you know, there's always a couple of ways that you could explain these videos. You know, so again, first of all, it's unnecessarily blurry, right? I mean, your cell phone could take a better video than what we're seeing.
That's true.
We're also only seeing a very small piece of the video. We're seeing just, you know, just from the right distance and a right angle where it could be suggestive of a mammoth, but you wonder, you know, why the person taking it didn't zoom in a little bit, or you know, try to focus,
or actually get closer,
get a little closer,
or get closer. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
What was the footage happening right before he turned?
Yeah, right after
reveal this thing. Right, it's only a 15-second clip or so. Right, where's the stuff before
where's
and after?
The story?
Yeah, plus. Yeah. There's other red flags. There was the claim that they found some of the mammoth hairs on the ground after it had exited the stream, and they claimed they brought it to a lab and they compared it to real bona fide mammoth hair, and they said that it was a match. And that was such a red flag for one key reason was that they didn't even mention the name of the lab. To me, that was a very critical bit of information. You would think that Steve, you're talking about people being savvy. You would think in these days of all these, you know, Bigfoot sightings and Nessie sightings that before going public, you would say, all right, I got to get my ducks in the row even a little bit. And they didn't. I mean, I would have bam, bam, bam. I would say, here's the lab. Here's what they said. Here's the report. And the other big thing that really got me is, I mean, you've got this huge exclusive and you're going to give it to the Sun. I mean, that's who you give it to. That inspires zero confidence in me. Game over just from that alone. Sorry. Yeah.
National Enquirer didn't want it, so the Sun took it.
You know, Bob, even if they went to the extreme that you were saying where they tried to button up all those holes and everything, I think their goal was just to get some publicity. You know, getting on the Sun was probably a lofty goal for them that they wanted. Anything bigger than that would probably almost impossible.
No, it's not bad. Absolutely. Find an outlet with no integrity whatsoever.
Of course, and that's my point. That's a red flag. That is it. This big klaxon that's going off. Wah wah wah. Yeah. This is a hoax. This is a hoax. And that's just one of them.
Yeah, there was no provenance of the video. It's only a very short piece of video. It's again the quality is perfect for mystery mongering, but not for actually figuring out what's on it. If it wasn't a hoax, it's doing a damn good job of imitating a hoax.
Well, guess what?
It looks like a duck.
It was a hoax.
What?
Yes.
Shocked.
Oh, I'm
shocked.
So sorry to break this to you all.
How do you know?
Are shocked.
Were you there? The internet knows because the original videographer came forward and offered the original video. So now we can see what happened before, during, and after the quote-unquote woolly mammoth crossed the river. And surprise of all surprises, guess what happened? Absolutely nothing. The video shows it's the exact same shot. You know, it's the same river. It's the same tree line. It's clearly the same video, yet there is no mammoth walking across the screen.
Yeah.
And you can even see that it's at the correct part of the video. The video he submitted is 4.5 minutes long, and you know, you can match it up to the video of the supposed woolly mammoth by looking at the way the waves are cresting and everything. And sure enough, there is no animal at all in the original footage.
Not an invisible mammoth, maybe?
It could be. That's actually a good point that has yet to be investigated. Invisible
That's
mammoth.
Right. Like the invisible dragon in my garage. Mm. Ha.
The videographer is Ludovic Petho, I think it's maybe Petho.
Yeah, it sounds like it was B-roll for a project he's working on.
Yeah, it's just a nice shot of a river scene that he took while he was on a backpacking trip through Russia. He's working on a project about his grandfather's escape from a Siberian POW camp, and he uploaded this footage to YouTube back in July of 2011.
So we know for 100% pretty much it's a hoax because we have the source video. But
indeed.
But he still had to superimpose a video of an animal walking across the river onto that background. It could be CG, but a lot of people before even the hoax data that you just said was revealed suspected that it actually was a video of a bear with a fish in its mouth. And I still think that's probably what it is. I think the guy took a video of a bear with a fish in its mouth, superimposed it over this static video to put it into a different context, and it's blurted out enough so that the fish can kind of look like a trunk. I think he might have even slowed it down to give it a more lumbering kind of look to it.
Mm.
If you're looking at the video with is this a mammoth, you know, stamped on top of it, then the suggestion can make you, it kind of looks like a mammoth. That's cool. But I showed, for example, the video to my 12-year-old daughter without telling her anything about what it was. I said, what do you think that is? And
Bigfoot.
She said, it's a bear. Like, why are you asking? It's so obviously a bear.
The bears.
With the fish.
And then when you think bear with a fish in its mouth, that's exactly what it looks like. So there's a bit of suggestibility going on, but I think that – and a lot of people pointed out that the trunk / fish is a different color than the rest of the animal.
Doesn't sway like a trunk, right? It's kind of just hanging there, limp.
Silvery in color. It's a bit.
So we have to kind of call upon Occam's razor to help us out, I think, at that point.
If we didn't have the proof of hoax, but we do have that, so now –
right.
Yeah, it was just a matter of how was it hoaxed is really the only question.
Right.
What are the technical details that were used to create it, but not what is it? So, alas, no baby mammoth.
Right.
But this is now the second hoax that I can think of that we talked about on the show that was uncovered because the source image was found on the internet somewhere.
You got to burn that stuff.
Yeah, but they're just, Bob, they're pulling it off of the internet. It's somebody else's picture or somebody else's video that's on.
Oh, I thought he actually filmed it himself.
No, it was somebody else. It's somebody else's video that he pulled off of YouTube.
That's his problem.
Yeah, Stephen, and you also said that he might have even shot this video of the bear. He probably pulled that from somewhere else, too.
Yeah, I doubt he actually did any work himself. Otherwise, he would have just done CGI because CGI would have looked way better and probably been easier than to go out and find a bear to videotape.
Yeah, so it's not like the fellow who put this video out there, Michael Cohen, has a history of this sort of behavior.
Probably not, no.
Right.
Yeah. No.
It's a first time.
It's a one-off. Yeah. Oh, wait.
Oh, no. Really?
apparently he does, but, you know.
I like his picture of an alien, which is just a picture of some kids in Africa somewhere. And if you look way, way in the background, there's a couple of blobs that are not even actually connected to each other. But if you use your imagination, one blob could be the head and the other blob could be the body of a little gray alien. That's just all pareidolia. But I think this guy, he gives all the hallmarks of just trying to profiteer on this sort of thing, Again, not exactly a reliable source.
No.
I think we blew this case wide open. Case of the baby mammoth.
Good job, team.
But still no mammoths with jetpacks. We're still at square one.
Sad.
All right, quick question, guys. So what happens to the publisher of that video? What happens to the guy that made the claim?
He goes on to make another one in a year or so.
Yep. Yeah, we wait for the next
people
one.
People forget about it. Evan, you know what time it is.
Who's that noisy time?
Yep.
Let us play last week's Who's That Noisy. Remember, we were looking for a theme for last week's Who's That Noisy. And here we go.
You know, if you get to be very successful, there's usually some point where you just happen to be lucky.
Yeah, I think that people don't realize that it's all about hard work.
Ladies and gentlemen and fellow New Yorkers.
So who do we have there? Did you guys recognize any of those voices?
No.
Nope.
None of them?
I really didn't.
Mick Jagger was the first voice. We all know who Mick Jagger is.
Yeah, yes. He's the mayor of New York, right?
Exactly.
I think he was in the Beatles.
Here's the next voice, right? Now, Victoria Beckham, right? You know who she is?
Oh, God.
I don't know her voice, though.
People don't realize that it's all about hard work.
Lady.
Right? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And the last voice, the tricky one, the one that kind of threw a lot of people, this is the former governor of the state of New York, David Paterson.
Gentlemen and fellow New Yorkers.
Now, what could these three people possibly all have in common that would make them a theme for a Who's That Noisy segment?
They're all full of it.
They're all full of it in some specific way.
Exactly. These three famous people in their own right are all Kabbalah admirers.
Oh, God.
We talked about David Paterson and his little string.
Yeah. So you have a couple of entertainers there, and the former governor of New York, which is an interesting combination. Nope, but they all have worn the red string of Kabbalah, which is, supposed to ward off misfortune and ward off the evil eye.
Didn't work for Paterson.
Well, we had a winner. Someone did put it all together. Someone by the name of T. Reinach from the message boards. I think this might have been his first post. So congratulations.
Mm, wow, congratulations.
Good job, T. Reinach.
Yeah, that's
well
really
done,
great.
T. Reinach.
And what do you have for this week? What stunning challenging, amazing, noisy did you put together for our listeners this week, Evan?
Today, this week, we have the classic version of Who's That Noisy?
A classic Who's That Noisy?
It's a classic. Here we go. Wow.
It's a crypt opening and with a zombie inside.
What the heck was that? Yeah, right?
It's a Halloween soundtrack.
I borrowed it from Bob, yes. Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome.
Go ahead and give us your guesses. Whether you think they're right or not, we'd like to hear from you. info@theskepticsguide.org, sguforums.com. Any way you want to contact us, let us know what you think. Give us a guess, and good luck to everyone.
Thanks, Evan.
I want a quickie with Bob.
Ugh. Oh, you just interrupted me. All right, Bob, give us a quickie.
You said it was okay.
That was a perfect time.
That was good. Go.
All right, Evan, this week's quickie with Bob. My title is Alien Matter is Infesting Our Solar System. It all starts with NASA's IBEX spacecraft in orbit around the Earth since 2008. It's been scanning the skies now for almost 4 years, and it has found elements from outside our solar system, and they're a little off. Normally, such particles can't get into our solar system. The solar wind of the sun puffs out its magnetic field to these monstrous proportions, wrapping our solar system in the heliosphere, which is just like a magnetic bubble that doesn't let nasty things like cosmic rays in. Neutral particles, however, can get in, and this is what the IBEX has detected. So far, it has detected 4 extrasolar elements, hydrogen, helium, oxygen, and neon. That last one is especially important because neon is unreactive. It's a noble gas, and there's a lot of it around, so we have lots of good statistics about neon. And so what they did was compare the indigenous neon and oxygen atoms, and they compared them to their counterparts that originated elsewhere in the galaxy. Now, for the latter, they found that for every 20 neon atoms, there was about 74 associated oxygen atoms. But for the homegrown stuff, the stuff that was in our, that was derived from our solar system, for every 20 neon atoms, there was 111 oxygen atoms. So that means that for every kind of random chunk of space that you might examine near the sun, there's going to be more oxygen compared to a similar chunk that you might take from interstellar space outside of the heliosphere. So why is that? I'll let David McComas, who is the principal investigator of IBEX, I'll let him answer that. He said that there are at least 2 possibilities. Either the solar system evolved in a separate, more oxygen-rich part of the galaxy than where we currently reside, or a great deal of critical life-giving oxygen lies trapped in interstellar dust grains or ices, unable to move freely throughout space and thus undetectable by IBEX. So we'll benefit from either answer because whichever it is, it's going to allow us to further refine our knowledge not only about how the solar system formed, but also the life that formed with it. So that was your quickie with Bob. I hope it was good for you too.
Bob, that was great. Fantastic.
Yeah. Do you guys know what the most common element in the Earth's crust is?
In the Earth's crust? Iron? No.
By weight. Let's go percentage by weight.
Aluminum.
Yeah, the one that...
Aluminum is number 3 at 8.1%.
Wow. I'd say...
carbon.
Iron? I'd say iron.
Iron is number 4 at 5.0%.
Nitrogen.
Nitrogen's not
this
in the top
like
10.
This is just like Family Feud.
Hydrogen.
Not even
Wait,
close.
Wait, where's my periodic
Hydrogen.
Table?
It
is silicon.
Silicon's 2, 27.7%.
Ooh, I'm so close.
Okay. Water.
It's nope. Not an element.
No, not an element.
Come on, oxygen, 46.6%.
I was so close.
You were, yes. Just except for those 2 molecules of hydrogen, you were right on.
Except for the science, yeah, you were good.
Ouch.
All right, we have time, I think, for a couple of emails this week. The first one comes from Paul Wilde in the UK, and Mr. Wilde writes, "Thanks so much for the show. My old granddad raised an interesting question recently. Can evolution be falsified? My initial reaction was, of course it can.
But, of course.
But of course. But it turned out that no matter how hard I thought about it, I couldn't come up with a way in which it could. So I turned to the web, and the best and only possible falsification that I can understand I could find is this, the discovery of a complete human fossil that is 3 billion years old. You can substitute the specifics, but you get the idea. What are your thoughts? If evolution can't be falsified, should it be discounted or at least somehow relegated as a scientific theory? I think not, but I struggle to find an answer to those that stipulate that science must be falsifiable." So this is one that we hear a lot from the creationists, that evolution is not falsifiable. What do you guys think about that?
It certainly doesn't have to be a complete human skeleton or whatever found.
It doesn't even have to be human.
It could be any fossil that is found outside, far outside of its strata with no explanation.
The classic answer for that is horses in the Cambrian.
It's hard, though, because you're dealing with a theory that's just so massive that it's hard to discount all of that with just one little discovery. I mean, you might be able to give a piece of it a problem, but there's just so much that you would have to explain, you know, in light of this new fact, that it's not as easy as just one fact unraveling it. You know what I mean? It's a lot more complicated than that because it's such a big, massive theory. It's not just one observation or just one idea. It's just a conglomeration of so many different ideas and observations and interrelated kind of observations and theories, you know?
Yeah, and that oversimplification of the theory of evolution, I think, betrays exactly what the problem is with a lot of creationists. They want there to be one simple answer. They want there to be one sentence in a book that we can point to say that evolution is real, you know, that will completely change their mind. And you know, on the opposite end, they think that they should be able to come up with one thing that can blow evolution out of the
water. The master stroke. Yeah, they're always looking for the one thing that completely by itself falsifies evolution. But at the very least, we have to separate evolution into its three main component theories. One is common descent. And what you're talking about with horses in the Cambrian or a human skeleton, you know, in the Precambrian layer, is that would blow common descent out of the water because, you know, that common descent requires that species occur in the fossil record in a certain pattern, in a pattern that's compatible with, you know, all species being related to each other and deriving from each other eventually. But the other component is natural selection, and that's certainly falsifiable. I mean, natural selection is a very complicated, you know, set of ideas about the mechanism of evolution. And while it is certainly the dominant theory about the mechanism of evolution and has a lot of support, evidentiary support, even, you know, serious evolutionary scientists, not creationists, certainly are still questioning whether or not other mechanisms might be playing a role and what the relative contribution is of various mechanisms. So I don't think you could just – and you can't just completely discount them or confuse natural selection for common descent. And the third component is just what evolved from what, and that is changing all the time, right? As we get a new fossil, with the specific picture of how things are related to each other changes. But to get back to the original question – evolution is false. You know, the fact of evolution, you know, that species derive from each other, common descent, is not only falsified by the existence of a clearly out of sequence specimen in the fossil record, but also if, for example, when we did a thorough survey of living creatures in the world, which, you know, although there's still obviously a lot of creatures we haven't identified, you know, we've identified, what did we say, like 10 million different creatures. Certainly a lot more than was known about in Darwin's day. We could have found clusters of creatures that had no morphological, genetic, or any other kind of physiological relationship to all other creatures that exist, right? But we don't find that. We find this lovely branching pattern of morphological relatedness that is completely compatible with evolution. When we find it morphologically, we find it genetically. And we find it when we look at proteins. No matter what level you look at people, at living things, we find this branching relation, this branching pattern of relatedness that you would predict from common descent. And all those lines of evidence could have completely falsified evolution.
Yeah, but Steve, if they did find these pockets of species that were not related in any way, but I don't think that would even necessarily falsify it. I mean, there's we've talked in the past about how there could be an alternate genesis of species that just survived and were unrelated to everything else. So I mean, I think it would have been really fascinating to find what do they call these species, the stealth, or they're just kind of like the hidden species that were just not related. They just evolved separately.
There would be a separate line of living things, but
right.
But that
right.
wouldn't But what I'm talking about is like, why don't, like, we don't see something that looks like a mammal but has an extra set of limbs.
Right.
There's always a derivation. We can always see embryologically, morphologically, how structures evolve. There aren't these extra structures just popping up in different species. We don't see mixtures of morphology. Like, we don't see lion with eagle wings. You know, these chimeras from mythology. They don't exist because that you couldn't really explain them evolutionarily. Right? They can't occur with evolution. What we do see is evolution constraining the morphology of the creatures that we do see in a very meaningful way. And, you know, which is yet another, you know, potential line of falsification. So pretty much every aspect of biology could have potentially falsified evolution and instead supported it. It's not just the fossil record, which that tends to get disproportionate attention. But it's actually not the strongest or the most dramatic evidence for evolution. I think personally it's the genetic evidence. You can, you know, calculate the odds of the genetics looking like it does if evolution were not true just by random, and it's essentially impossible. You know, it's odds are greater than age of the universe. The only other possibility is a capricious, you know, deity decided to make the world look exactly as if it had evolved for some reason.
There you go.
Psych.
All right, let's do one more email. This one comes from Joanna Wintjes. I probably butchered that name, from Menlo Park, California. And she writes, my 13-year-old daughter is being required to wear headgear to prevent concussion during soccer games and practices. I have researched extensively on PubMed, but cannot find much support that these headbands will prevent concussion. What I have so far, females are more likely to get concussions than males. Properly heading the ball does not cause concussion. Colliding with a person or goal post will give you a concussion. Pro soccer players will show some damage to their heads. I am being told to buy the headgear just to be on the safe side, but I object to doing things for no clear benefit. Can you advise on whether the data supports purchase of soccer headgear for a 13-year-old female to wear during playing and practices? Many thanks for any help. Everyone is either laughing at me or acting as if I do not want my kid to be safe. I do want her safe, but not in a padded cell. All right, so this is a very interesting question. It has to do with risk versus benefit, and, you know, the cautionary principle, and what evidence should we require before doing something that seems obvious, like wearing a padded helmet to reduce the risk of head injury during an active sport. But things are not always that simple, and sometimes things that may superficially make sense may even be counterproductive. What do you think, Rebecca?
Well, I was really interested in this because I don't play soccer. I never was any good at it, but I've seen this argument come up a lot in regards to bikes. A lot of people enjoy arguing that bike helmets aren't worth it, mostly because, you know, they say that there's not enough evidence that they can't cause more harm in certain sorts of accidents, and also evidence that they, you know, reduce the likelihood that people will bike, you know, so they take away biking's health benefits, things like that. So, yeah, I find it really interesting. So I started looking into the facts, and Joanna sent along a few good links to get me started. So here's kind of a quick overview of what I found. Most soccer injuries involve the feet and legs, of course, but a lot of kids injure their face and heads playing soccer, and a lot of those injuries are concussions. Concussions make up probably about 2-3% of all injuries, which is the same rate as American football. And of course, we make American football players wear helmets, especially little kids. Joanna linked to one study of adolescents in Oakville, Canada, that showed a pretty shocking 47.8% of kids experienced symptoms of a concussion during the previous year, which I found quite horrific. So a lot of the data seems to suggest that head injuries might be pretty common amongst young soccer players, so it's understandable that people would want to do something about it. The Canadian study found that 52.8% of all the kids who didn't wear helmets suffered a concussion, compared to 26.9% of kids who did wear headgear, and more girls than boys were injured. Joanna also linked to a study from 2008 that looked at sex differences in 44 college players who wore helmets. And that study showed that when performing headers, which is, you know, bonking the ball with your head, the men were protected by the helmets, but the women showed a 10% increase in head acceleration, which is linked to brain injury. However, the numbers were far below what would usually be required for injury to occur. The balls they were throwing at the people's heads were relatively low speed. The researchers think that wearing the helmet encourages players to hit the ball harder, which is something called risk homeostasis or risk compensation. And that's studied across all kinds of sports. And it's also one of the things that's brought up in terms of bike helmets. Some people claim that wearing bike helmets encourages riskier behavior. Whether that is true or not is a topic of quite a lot of discussion.
That comes up in a lot of contexts. I remember that issue coming up with SUVs when people thought that, oh, SUVs are safer vehicles, that therefore, because they're in a big vehicle, so they drive more recklessly and get into more accidents.
Yeah, I think there are some areas where risk homeostasis is a real thing, and I think there are other areas where people assume it is because it's a factor in other areas, but there's not necessarily a lot to back it up. So this study does suggest that there is some amount of risk compensation when it comes to soccer players and helmets. And they think that both sexes are compensating for the safety offered by the helmets, but women were more at risk due to their lower head mass and neck strength. So after hearing about that study, you might think that helmets wouldn't be of much use to girls. However, remember that study was actually looking at headers, which aren't, in fact, the cause of any immediately recognizable brain injury, like Joanna mentioned in her email. The most common cause of concussion is not from heading the ball, but is actually from bonking heads with another player. The second most common cause of concussion is from having a ball kicked straight into your melon. So something that happens accidentally, your head just gets in the way, and you take it, you know, pretty hard, because people can kick balls pretty quickly, pretty fast. So in these situations, there wouldn't be any risk compensation, just the player's head accidentally colliding with something at a high speed. And in that case, the data does show that helmets can increase safety, because they wouldn't be compensating for the risk. One more brief note about heading the ball. There have been studies that suggest that even properly heading a ball constantly for a long period of time can have some nasty effects. One study found that among adult soccer players in Norway who have played since they were children and who haven't had a severe head injury caused by a non-soccer injury, 81% showed mild to severe deficits in attention, concentration, wow, and memory. Players who headed the ball more frequently had higher rates of cognitive loss. And there's been at least one other study that suggested that kids might be injured heading the ball on a regular basis at a younger age. However, Joanna linked to another well-controlled study of 240 college players that found no significant mental impairments, despite an average of about 15 years playing soccer. So I couldn't find many other studies on heading, and so I'm willing to say that the jury is still out on that. So to sum up my feelings on the data, speaking as a non-scientist, non-medical professional who doesn't have kids, who doesn't play soccer, and admittedly is a bit annoyed by the present day sort of overly protective society, it looks to me like helmets are probably a good idea for kids playing soccer, and also maybe they shouldn't go crazy on the headers when they're very young. But honestly, even if you don't make your kid wear a helmet, he or she is probably still going to be way healthier than a kid who doesn't run around playing games at all.
Good point.
So, yeah, you're probably still not a terrible parent, even if you choose not to slap a helmet on your kid. But, yeah, from the data I looked at today, it seems to me that, you know, it probably is worth playing it safe if you can afford a helmet.
Yeah, that was kind of my sense too. I think the header issue is probably a red herring largely. People focus on that because it's something about – it's the only sport you know, where you actually deliberately engage the ball with your head.
Right.
So people focus on that, but there the data is ambiguous.
Yeah.
But it's actually the bigger risk is from other head injuries, head to body. Yeah.
Yeah, head to head and head to ball, but the head to ball is purely accidental.
The ball being thrown at somebody's head and they're not prepared for it, so they're not stabilized.
One of the studies I saw on concussions said that zero concussions were caused by heading, and all of them were caused by head-to-head or head-to-ball accidentally.
All right, well, thanks for the interesting question. Well, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. You guys want to hear the theme?
Not really.
All right. We'll go with Rebecca's way. You guys can figure out.
I know. I was being sarcastic.
Oh, too bad. Yeah. Here we go. Out of one, programmers have created a computer program that can score 150 on a standard IQ test. Item number two. Programmers have developed software that can monitor video chat in real time and accurately detect deception and other emotions in the target. And item number three, forensic scientists have developed a system for identifying unknown skulls by computer comparison to pictures of living people. Rebecca, why don't you go first this week?
All right, let me guess. The theme is squirrels.
Squirrels, that's correct. These all have to do with squirrels.
Yes. The theme is news items I have not read this week.
That's always the theme. I try to make it the theme every week.
That's true. You've been getting better at that, actually. Okay. A computer program that can score 150.
Up in the game. Always up in the game.
On a standard IQ test. Yeah, 150. That's easy enough. We've all done that. IQ... I'm trying to think of what goes into IQ tests, and most IQ tests aren't some brilliant scheme for deducing intelligence. It's just a test you can study for. If you can study for it, you can certainly program a computer to pass one. So that makes sense to me. Software that can monitor video chat in real time and accurately detect deception and other emotions in the target. Now that's tricky because we do have certain ways of detecting deception in people. However, those techniques are highly inaccurate. And, you know, most of the best clues we have for detecting deception aren't visual. They are more auditory. They are based on what the person is saying, how they're describing certain events. For instance, it's been shown that visual tics that we're all taught, like the subject rubbing his nose means he's lying, that sort of thing, those are highly inaccurate. So I'm suspicious of that one. A system for identifying unknown skulls by computer comparison to pictures of living people. That makes sense to me. You know, we already have security cams in Vegas casinos that can accurately match up faces. And plus, I saw it once on Bones. So I'm pretty sure that already exists in the Bones universe, which means it's only a matter of time before it exists here, I'm sure. I'm going to go with video chat accurately detecting deception. That one's just too bizarro for me to believe.
Okay, Jay.
Okay, these all three have to do with software or programmers.
Correct. You get bonus points for that.
Thank you.
Damn it.
The first one about the 150 on the standard IQ. As much as I thought I was relatively familiar with an IQ test, now that I think about it, I'm not that familiar with it. I know that it, on a basic level, what it's judging people on. I also know that 150 on an IQ test is pretty serious. Huh, that's interesting, but I guess because I'm not crystal clear on what it's judging you on and if there'd be a significant difference between the way that answers are answered as opposed to it just answering factually, because it might be contextually. that could have an impact on that. And that's interesting, but I wouldn't doubt that at this point. Programmers, the second one about the programmers developing software about monitoring video chat and seeing if it could detect deception or other emotions in the target. I don't disagree with Rebecca's assessment on that, and I just think it's very difficult for people to even detect other people's emotions accurately sometimes. And, you know, software to do it is just, it's a very difficult thing. And it's not like you didn't mention anything about it reading blood pressure or any of that stuff. And even though, even if it were, we'd know today that, you know, you need a baseline in order to determine if there's even any real effect. And even then, it's not that accurate. So that's a pretty big thing you're saying there, Steve. So I'm not sure about that one. And then the last one about the forensic scientist being able to identify unknown skulls. I don't know. You ever see someone that just has like jowls? You know, that's all soft tissue. You don't see a skull with jowls, you know? I don't, you know, and as funny as that is, I'm serious too, because that doesn't come across. But maybe it's still, maybe there's indications, you know, maybe that looks where the chin is and whatnot. I don't know though. I don't know about that one, Steve. So I will go with Rebecca and say that the one about the video chat situation, that is BS.
Okay, Bob.
All right, computer program 150. You know, I keep going back to the Watson computer that did so well on that game show, trying to think that similar technology would allow a computer to do that well. And yeah, Jay, I'm not really familiar with IQ tests and exactly what kind of questions they ask, so that's hindering me in coming to a conclusion for this one. But for the third one, now Steve, you've got this unknown skull, and then I'm kind of a little confused about what living people you're talking about. What's the relation? You know what I mean? If you've got the skull, how do you know what living people to compare it to?
That is a very good question.
Okay, bastard. All right, I'm going to leave that one for now. The second one, yeah, I've got a problem with this one a bit too, primarily because of real time. I think doing this in real time would be really difficult. And of course, the you know, video chat is, you know, notoriously low res. I'm assuming it's just a conventional video chat that's not really very high res. I think that might be a factor. You know, but there, I'm confused about this one. I mean, there are ways to determine if somebody's being deceptive, you know, just in terms of how many times they use like the word I or how verbose they are. People who lie tend to be less verbose. And that kind of stuff is amenable to software and, that monitors video chat. So yeah, I think you could, using, biometrics, you could look at a skull and then look at a person and you could, I think you'd be possible to determine. If that skull belonged to a person similar to that, maybe somebody, you know, a relative or, yeah, but God, I'm not sure about. I think I'll go with the video chat. The real time, I think, is what sells that one to me, and to do it accurately and emotions. Oof. This is, yeah, I guess I'll go with that one. Say that one is fiction, video chat.
Evan, your turn.
You don't expect me to kind of stay out in the cold and guess against everyone else, right? I mean, that would just kind of.
That would be brave.
I'm not that brave this week, and I'll spare everyone the lengthy thoughts
too
rolling
late.
Around in
What's
my
your
head.
Answer?
I'm going to go with Rebecca J. Bob.
GWRBJ.
They haven't failed me yet.
All right, so we'll take these in order, I suppose. Item number one, programmers have created a computer program that can score 150 on a standard IQ test. You all think that one is science. And yeah, you know, the key to that one is knowing what kind of tasks are involved in the standard IQ test. For example, pattern recognition, things that computers are not traditionally good at, seeing what a group of items have in common, you know, because there's some abstract theme to them. For example, like knowing that all three of these items were about computer programs.
Ooh.
And computers generally score around in the 80s. Even, you know, artificial intelligence software designed to do well on those tests only get up to the 80s. But this one is science, because computer programmers have sort of broken through and found algorithms
Yay.
That do allow computers to do much better than ever before on standardized IQ tests, specifically because of coming up with pattern recognition algorithms that allow them to perform those kinds of tasks. This is MIT researchers that did this. Not surprising, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So rather than examining data in a more linear fashion or just comparing it to a database, the algorithm allows it to look at it from multiple different angles and to begin to see like the features that it possesses in common, and then use that to derive the category or the best fitting structure, for example, to the data. So it's a new approach to artificial intelligence, and this should help drive artificial intelligence software forward. So that is a pretty big breakthrough, actually. It's a pretty big
Sweet.
Jump, from scoring in the 80s to 150.
Fantastic, Matt.
Fantastic. Let's go on to number two. Programmers have developed software that can monitor video chat in real time and accurately detect deception and other emotions in the target. You all think this one is the fiction. Bob, you're caught up on the real-time aspect of this. Mm-hmm. That's interesting because that has actually nothing to do with why this is the fiction.
Hooray!
Yay! Yeah! I'm so happy.
Right for the wrong reasons. Love it.
The headline of the real news item was Lovelorn Liars Leave Linguistic Leads. So this is about detecting deception, but as I think Rebecca and Bob both hit upon, this is more about detecting deception by the word choices that people make. And it's not in video, but it's in profiles that people leave on online dating services. And they essentially came up with a way of analyzing the profiles and coming up with a ascertainment of how deceptive the person is. And it does, Bob, you hit upon some, like how often do they use the word I, specific information do they give. If they don't give a lot of physical descriptions of themselves, then that suggests that maybe the picture that they have of themselves is deceptive. It's not an accurate portrayal of reality. Here's another one, if they flip language, if instead of describing themselves as happy, they describe themselves as not sad, that's a sign of being deceptive.
Mm. Who does that?
I don't know.
Liars.
I'm not sad, everybody. Not going to kill you.
I'm not sad.
Yeah, so that one was fiction, but the real one's real story was interesting as well. But yeah, just from video, it was the key that the computer was analyzing the video and doing the lie to me kind of thing of looking at how people's facial expressions are moving, et cetera. That's fiction. Which means that forensic scientists have developed a system for identifying unknown skulls by computer comparison to pictures of living people is science.
Great.
Fantastic, Matt.
Once again, I think you guys underestimated how difficult this task was and how much of a breakthrough it was.
Whatever, Steve. Good job, everybody.
And Bob, once again, I think similar to last week, you were overly impressed with the way things are portrayed on TV.
Well, you just that can't help but be a jackass.
You sweep me. I've got to come up with something.
Yeah, even when
right?
we beat him.
Right?
I need something. So anyway, the problem is that there actually
I don't watch TV.
Isn't a good correlation between – and actually, Jay, I think you said that like there's not a lot of correlation between the way the skin hangs on the skull and the
– Yes, I did.
The bony prominences itself. So if you look at – the landmarks, like those very specific points on the skull, and then you compare them to the soft tissue that overlies it, the skin and muscle. The old methods of making that extrapolation actually are very inaccurate. And I think it was Bob who said, you look at the picture, doesn't really look a lot like what was reconstructed. So what these researchers did was they did a systematic analysis of skulls and pictures of living people in order to compare how the skin and muscle relates to the bone. And Bob, you asked about how could they do that? How could they compare skulls with living people? They did CAT scans and did a 3D virtual reconstruction of the skull and then used the virtual skull as the source and then compared that to the key features, sort of landmarks on the picture of the person on the face of, based upon a picture, to the landmarks on the skull. And they use that to develop the relationship between what the person looks like and what their skull looks like.
But you said unknown skulls.
So then they applied it to an unknown, a real case.
Okay.
Which, of course, if you don't close the loop on that, then you don't know how useful it is. And in the follow-up study, they actually did apply it to an unknown. It's hard to know from the sources that I read exactly how far they've taken this. I get the feeling that it's being oversold a little bit. But one part of the of an article I read about it said that it was as accurate as DNA analysis, but I really couldn't find anything to justify that statement. It may be true, but I just don't know. But it is, however, or potentially can be a relatively quick and inexpensive method for analyzing a skull and then comparing it to possible people that it could be belong to, missing persons, etc. And also could be very useful in excluding people, not saying this is the person that it matches, but this really can't be the person that this skull belongs to, and therefore saving expensive DNA analysis for that person, right? So it could narrow the field of people that you would then do confirmatory tests on, like DNA analysis. So it would just be one more tool in the toolkit, and much better than the reconstructions that were previously done, because now there's some pretty objective data comparing pictures of actual people of known targets to, you know, again, the 3D reconstructions of their skull. And also because they were just using live, you know, volunteers as subjects, they were able to do 500 people. So probably it would be probably difficult to do that from unknown forensic cases. You know, take a long time to gather those cases, but...
Good job, everybody.
Yep, good job, everyone.
Yep. Go us.
Wow, Jay.
Well, I guess that brings us to the end of the program. We have nothing left to do at this
Suddenly.
Point.
Suddenly, yes.
I have a quote over here, okay? People want to hear the quote.
Oh, that's right, the quote.
Rebecca, wasn't it Darwin Day not too long ago?
Yes, it was.
Have you ever heard of Charles Darwin?
Doesn't ring a bell. Is he Bob Darwin's brother?
On the Origin of Species, perhaps?
Didn't he write books on barnacles?
Well, here's a quote from that book. I think you guys should read it. Charles Darwin said, "It is a truly wonderful fact, the wonder of which we are apt to overlook from familiarity, that all animals and all plants throughout all time and space should be related to each other in group subordinate to group."
Charles Darwin!
That was sent in by Chris Friedrich. Friedrich. F-R-I-E-D-R-I-C-H.
Friedreich.
Speaking of Germans, I'm going to be in Germany, and that's an announcement I would like to make now. I will be doing a couple of conferences. First, I'm going to be at the Women in Secularism Conference, run by CFI in Washington, D.C. Well, technically, I think it's in Arlington, Virginia, but that's Friday, May 18th through Sunday, May 20th. I will be there on Friday and Saturday, a bit of Saturday, because on Saturday I fly to the 6th World Skeptics Conference in Berlin, Germany. That's May 18th to 20th. And the following week I will be in Cologne with many of my atheist friends at the AAI conference. That is May 25th through 27th. So I hope to see some of you there. At one of those places.
Flügen is German for fly.
Thank you, Evan. Now I just need to know, bring me a pint of your finest beer, please.
Well, thanks for joining me, everyone, this week.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Curly.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.